With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to IFHPodcastNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 152. Not a wasted word. This has been the main point of my literary thinking all my life. Hunter S. Thompson.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft, it's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro-budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T, chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have VJ Boyd, a writer and showrunner that has been working in Hollywood for years. And our conversation goes throughout his career, how he got his first jobs working in the writer's room to becoming his own showrunner. He's worked on shows like Justified and SWAT. He really goes deep into what it takes to be a writer inside the studio system, writing for network television as well as cable and streaming. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with VJ Boyd. I'd like to welcome to the show VJ Boyd. How you doing, VJ?
Hey, doing all right. Happy to be here, Alex.
Thank you so much for being on the show, man. Before we get started, man, first of all, huge fan of Justified. Like, huge, huge fan. I've binged the entire series with my wife. So thank you for that.
Thank you for that was my favorite job. That I've probably had ever. That was a lot of fun. I learned a lot, and we had a lot of freedom on that show. We didn't like when we would break an episode, it wasn't super tight. We kind of knew the basics of what was going to happen. So then when I went away to write it, I got to put in all my fun little idiosyncrasies, and we had a lot of fun with that show.
Yes. Cool. So we'll do a little deeper dive into that. But first, how did you get started in this ridiculous business?
When I was 11, I got interested in writing just as a hobby. And although, anyone, like as they're a kid or a teenager, you know, like anyone else who's interested in it, I certainly had dreams of, oh, I could do this for a living and would daydream about that. But I didn't think that that was really within my reach. It was one of those things where, well, maybe, like I might win the lottery. And so I got a business degree and I worked at IBM for a while in Dallas, where I grew up. I started going to grad school because I wasn't super happy working at IBM. It's a fine place to work. I was in sales, but I started feeling like everyone around me was insane. And what I realized is, oh, no, they're not insane. It's that I think they're crazy because they're liking what they're doing and I hate what I'm doing. So it's just that I'm in the wrong place. They're not crazy. They're just enjoying their job and I need to find what I enjoy. And so I was going to grad school and thinking that I would teach, thinking, oh, if I teach, then I'll have more time to write, which is very stupid, which I quickly discovered. Teachers don't have free time. It's not like they have all summer off. And so I then transitioned to, okay, well, I'll get my master's in literature and then maybe my PhD and I'll teach at college, you know, because then, you know, it's adults. I don't have to worry about the responsibility of like taking care of like teenagers. And then I realized that, adjunct professors barely make a living wage. And no one really gets tenure anymore. So I'm still going to have a second job and I still won't have time to write. And I had a professor in grad school, Tony Daniel, who's a novelist and an editor at Bain Books. And he was like, you have real talent in screenwriting. You should try and do that for a living. And I was like, yeah, but like there's not really a career path. It's like you write a feature and it either sells or it doesn't. And then you spend another 6 months to a year writing a feature and it sells or it doesn't. That seems very dangerous. And he was like, well, my good friend Mike Taylor writes on Battlestar Galactica and says that in TV there's kind of a career path. You can, you know, start in the mailroom, so to speak. You can start as an assistant and work your way up. And that I started researching that, and that made sense to me. That was a thing that I could see. Okay, I can see the steps to that. It doesn't feel like I'm just I'm moving out to LA on a wing and a prayer or whatever. So right. I thought about it for a little while. And honestly, it was like less than a year after Tony recommended I should just pursue it that I quit my job at IBM, had to like sell the BMW, you know, and because I was going to end up like working for minimum wage in LA and I needed all that money. I cashed out my pension. My wife cashed out her pension. Wow. So kudos to her for being willing to do all that. So we used that savings, moved to LA in 2008. It was right when the writer's strike was ending, which was good timing because unfortunately, so many assistants at that time had to leave LA because there were no jobs because of the writer's strike. And so I came in right when the writer's strike was ending and I started cold calling looking for assistant jobs because I was like, hey, I've got this savings. I'll start at the bottom. And I would look in the trades and it's like when a show would get picked up, I would find the number for the production company and call them and be like, hey, can I send my resume? I'm looking for an assistant job. And one of these times, the show The Beast, which was Patrick Swayze's last thing before he passed, that had just gotten picked up to series. And so I called the number in, if anyone remembers, the Hollywood Creative Directory, because this was before everything was just on the – this was before IMDb Pro and stuff. And so a guy answered, hello. And I was like, yeah, is this the Beast, the writer's room for The Beast? And it was just the cell phone of one of the producers. And it was actually, I should say it's this guy, Stephen Pearl, who's become a friend of mine. And I actually last week visited in New Orleans and he showed me around. I'd never been to New Orleans. But anyway, so Stephen was like, no, this is my cell phone. I said, hey, I'm looking for an assistant job. You know, is your writer's room starting up? And he's like, I don't know. I'll call you back. And he actually did call me back. And was like, yeah, we are starting up next week. We don't have any assistants. Come interview. And I went and interviewed with the job. I interviewed with Vincent Angel, who was one of the creators. And you've also seen in stuff. He's an actor. He always plays the other man in Californication. He was like banging Duchovny's wife. And but great guy, Vincent. So he interviewed me and hired me as the lowest level assistant, the writer's PA. So there's normally three tiers of assistant. I was the lowest one. And I was super lucky, honestly, that everyone in that writer's office was such a weirdo, because like I didn't like I was coming from a different world, like a corporate world. I'd never worked in show business. I just moved to LA.
Right.
Like there were it's a different culture.
Sure.
And so I just didn't quite. I definitely made some missteps and everything, but the fact that so many of like my bosses and the other writers were honestly such weirdos. One of the weirdest writer's offices I've been in. That it just fell through the cracks and was like, that's another weirdo. So it was a perfect spot for me. They were all super cool and read my stuff. Then when that show ended, I was out of work for like a year and the cold calling thing wasn't working. And I was like, man, did I just get lucky? And I'm not going to like, am I going to have to like start working on set, which is another way of going, right? You can mm-hmm. work as a set PA and then, you know, network with the writers for the show and try to get in the writer's office. And I wasn't ready to give up. I wasn't giving up. But then this guy, Keith Schreier, who I'd met on The Beast, he was one of the other assistants. He, out of nowhere, I hadn't even asked him. He was like, hey, I found out that like Vince Gilligan is looking for assistance for this show Breaking Bad. Also Graham Yost is looking for assistance for this show called Lawman, which was what Justified was first called. And I was like, yes, please send my resume. And Keith not only sent my resume around, he actually made my resume look better. He's like, hey, can you send me the Word version? Because I think you need to format it better. So I ended up getting interview with Graham Yost to be his assistant. And I thought the interview went pretty well. And then he called me a week later and was like, hey, man, so I decided to hire this other friend of mine. Tom Hanks' assistant wants to transition into like the writing world. So she's going to be my assistant. I'm sorry, but we do have this writer's PA job. It's the lowest level job. I know you already did that. And I was like, yes, I'll do it. Yes, please. Right. And at that point, by the way, I had never read Elmore Leonard before. I knew who Elmore Leonard was, but I mostly, honestly, knew who Elmore Leonard was because Quentin Tarantino talks about Elmore Leonard all the time.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, so I read like the short story that Justified was based on and the other two books Raylan Givens is in, because I was like, I know I'm the assistant, but I was like, what if they like ask for pitches? Because, someone will ask the assistant what they think and I want to be ready. Anyway, so I ended up writer's PA on that first season. Going into second season, I was Justified was on hiatus. I was working as the writer's assistant on Falling Skies, which Graham was also running at that time, season one. While I was there, I was about to have my first kid. So I was about to be in a position where if I don't get staffed, then I'm going to be staying home with the kids because my wife has a real job at an insurance company. So I'm going to be like holding the kid and writing my next like script spec here. Graham found out season two of Justified was coming, and I was thinking, okay, maybe if I can somehow be moved from writer's PA to writer's assistant, then I'll get a freelance script, right? Like, and then maybe the next season I can be a staff writer, right? I'm thinking that. So Graham offers all the writers their jobs back, and one of the writers, the lowest level writer, staff writer, chose not to come back. So there's one spot open. And Graham was like, Graham hates like having to, which I understand having done it now a few times, having to interview like 20, 30 people
and
turn a bunch of people down. And so he was like, he had read a couple of my scripts and he was like, do you want the job? And I was like, yes. I mean, obviously I want the job. So I was able to like jump over those extra 2 years that you often have to do of being the in-room assistant and then getting a freelance and then finally getting staff writer. So I went right from writer's PA to staff writer and very, very lucky. But I always say that I was prepared for the opportunity, you know, because like when Graham said he'd read my stuff, I had a lot of quality pilots that I felt comfortable giving him, you know. And I should also add, I always think this is funny. I gave him two scripts. And one of them was a crime procedural. And I was like, this is the one he's going to like. And I was like, I'll throw this sci-fi one in as well. Because like a sci-fi script for Justified. But the crime procedural he didn't like. And he ended up, I found out this later, he gave the sci-fi script to his assistant and was like, yeah, tell me if I should even read this. And she was like, oh, I really like this. You should read it. And he read it and really liked it. And if she had said something different or if I'd only given the crime procedural, I wouldn't have gotten that job. Hopefully something would happen eventually, but getting on Justified, which ended up being a really well-respected show,
yeah,
and was a great show to learn. I mean, that was, and it kept coming back, huge for my career. Yeah. You know, instead of keeping on, what happens to so many people, you're on a show and it gets canceled. So you have to go on a new show and it gets canceled. And so it makes it hard to move up and it hurts your resume. So
right. And what I discovered Justified during the pandemic and I just binged the entire
series. Oh, wow. So that would be a very interesting way to watch it. Like, honestly, I have not watched the whole series since I left the show.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to do that and see, because it must be such an odd experience, because for us, we're making it over the course of 6 years, right?
Of course, of course.
And so if you're watching all of it, you're going like straight from season one to two to three, you probably see those changes so much more clearly.
Oh, yeah, adjustments in tone sometimes and adjustments in just character. Yeah, I mean, we discovered it because I'd always heard Justified was a good show. I always heard about it in the background, but like, you know, like everything else, there's 1,000 good shows and there's, people get busy. So like, when am I going to sit down and like, really? So when we were looking down and my wife's like, hey, why don't we give Justified a shot? I'm like, all right, let's give it a shot. I hear it's great. Let's give it a shot. And it just, we got hooked and we're like, and we're really looking forward to hopefully the spinoff that is happening. I heard in the trades that they are going to come back somehow.
There we worked on that, which by the way, that was awesome this year. We did 20 weeks or something like that of a room for City Primeval, the Justified spinoff. And it's one of those things where you never expect in this industry to end up working with the same group of people that you worked with in the past. Like maybe one or two of the same people.
Sure.
But the same group of people with a couple of additions, because we had Walter Mosley in the room for a little while, who I knew from Snowfall, is awesome. Also Issa Davis, who's an actress and writer. So we had added them. But other than that, it was the old crew.
That's amazing.
It was very cool. So we'll see. We have no shooting date yet, because one of those things where they did a room, but they didn't commit to shooting it. And also, like, we have to like figure out, it's obviously a big deal to bring that back and we want to do it right. Hopefully we'll get the go ahead to shoot it this next year. But I like what we came up with.
Well, I'm excited about that. And I always find it fascinating, you know, with writers and writers' rooms. When you are writing in a writer's room, and especially early on in season one, and you start seeing what the actors are doing on set with your words, does the writer's room start to adjust the tone, the language, to take advantage of the performance of that actor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that, honestly, I think that is one of the advantages to the old way of doing things of you make a pilot and then you get picked up and make the rest of the show. You know, I get the disadvantages of, okay, we have to like make a whole pilot and then wait around to see if we get to make the rest. I get that everyone's kind of waiting around, not getting paid and everything. But once you start writing the rest of them, you know exactly how everyone talks and you can write to that. If you use the model that the streaming uses, that Hulu, Netflix, Amazon use, although Amazon sometimes makes pilots, not so much anymore, but like Netflix, certainly you go in and you write them all. You write all 6 to 8 episodes.
Right.
Then you go shoot them all and you absolutely are going to end up rewriting stuff on the fly. Cause you're like, oh crap, this guy's really popping, or, oh man, I wrote this character this way, but that's not quite the way they play it. Right. And that's also one of the downsides of the streaming model of, it's only a couple of the writers who remain through the shooting. Like, you have the room for 20 weeks or so, but then it's just the creator and maybe one other producer there for the rest of the time, and you are absolutely going to end up, like you're talking about, rewriting for the actors. But no, it totally changes things. Just being on set with the actors, with the director, it changes the way you write things, because you've now had discussions with people who do these other jobs and you understand the way they think.
Yeah, because I'm just on a comedy standpoint, like I'm assuming first season of Big Bang Theory, when they started seeing Sheldon pop, I mean, I'm assuming they're like, wait a minute, we didn't think this character was going to be the breakout, but let's start working, or the Friends crew. I mean, the right. Friends writers' room, like that first season of Friends.
Or think about Family Matters with.
Oh yeah! Oh my God!
Like yeah.
Oh Jesus! Can you imagine Sophia? Like all of a sudden, Sophia, like okay, she's popping. We got to do something here, and rework things. But yeah, I always find that fascinating on how writers will start, because you don't get to do that in feature. You get it in TV and in streaming, but you don't get to do that in feature all the time.
Although yes, I mean certainly. I would say though that the way big features are now, they do so many reshoots, many reshoots that I'm sure that's I'm not as familiar with it, but I'm sure that sort of thing happens where they'll watch a screening and be like, "Crap, like that character." Write a subplot for that character and reshoot that, and we'll delay the release for a couple of months or something. I'm sure that sort of thing happens. Not so much with like indie film, but if you have the money or time to reshoot, like I know people who were producers on the new James Bond movie, mm-hmm. and when they were shooting that, like they were already shooting, obviously huge production, right?
Huge.
They were already shooting it. The script was not finished. Like they had like 250 pages of script and were just shooting the scenes they knew were going to stay while what's her name from Fleabag and was like whittling it down to what it was going to be, you know? So Even with the big movies, things change on the fly.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. Now, I always find it fascinating as well how writers in a writer's room break a story. So can you kind of go through the process, at least in your experience, how you approach, you know, as a showrunner, but also as a writer in the writer's room? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
And now back to the show. Let's take it back to Justify. First season, you're the second season, you're in the writer's room now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do you approach breaking a story and what are you seeing around you?
So with Justified, we had a lot of lead time because we were a cable show. So like if you're on a broadcast show, like when I was on SWAT, we would only have a couple months to like start writing and have lead time before it was time to shoot. So we only had a little bit of time to blue sky or just brainstorm. On Justified, we had more like 4 months before we started to shoot, if I remember correctly. So and we're doing fewer episodes, only 13. So we would spend like the first 3 weeks, sometimes even a month, but the goal was always like 2 or 3 weeks, just sitting in the room and throwing out like anything that could possibly happen that we're interested in. You know, like we could be like I remember season 4. That was the season with Drew Whatsit and the bag that was hidden in the the wall and the guy who like crash landed in the teaser. Like,
yeah.
We talked for 2 or 3 days about a version of season 4 in which there was going to be a flashback story we were going to tell episode to episode about Raylan's dad and Boyd's dad doing crime back in the day. Like, we started breaking that, and then we abandoned it after a couple of days because we realized people aren't tuning in to see these guest actors play their dads, unless we're having Oliphant and Goggins play their dads, which wouldn't work for Goggins. He doesn't look a thing like MC Gainey. then we're going to have to like abandon that idea. And so we would go down various paths. So thinking about season two, we had just visited Harlan. For the first time. Yeah, because we didn't go before season one. So several of us went down to the actual Harlan, and Graham had a lot of specific ideas from having been in Harlan. And he wanted to do something in the world of weed. He knew he wanted to do something with a criminal matriarch. So we had those ideas that he had thrown out. And so then there's the eight of us or however many there were that season. And we're pitching, okay, well, the matriarch could be like this. And I don't remember who pitched it, but it could be like – but it was like, okay, what if she had these sons that Raylan knew? Because that's the whole idea with Justified, right, is he's going back to the place he's from. So running into people he knew or knew of or that know of him, that's a big part of the show. And we were like, okay, what are these sons like, right? And so we started pitching on what they could be like, and like what we oftentimes will have like actors that we will call them by, like, oh, the Nick Nolte character or the whatever, before we've given them names to kind of get in our head like who they are. And like I remember season two of Justified, there was what was the oldest son's name? Because there was Coover and Dickie, and then oldest son. Yeah, I can't remember, but he, because obviously Coover and Dickie kind of steal the show. But like, I pitched like he could be the sheriff, like he could be like a cop, like so that he has there's some color of law, so it's lawman against lawman, and that ended up sticking. So it's that sort of thing. And sometimes, again, we're always going down paths that we end up like, okay, that doesn't work. Let's go down the other path. So anyway, the first, 3 weeks to a month, we're just coming up with the big, broad ideas. And as things land, we put them up there as tent poles for the season. Like, well, maybe mid-season, this kind of thing could happen. Right. You know, like, and by the end of the season, we want this sort of a thing to happen. So then after those 3 weeks or so, now we're in the room and it's time to make up what's going to happen actually in episode one. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then we got to get more specific, and we draw those columns on the board, sure. Like teaser, act one, act two, blah, blah, blah. And we just, again, we start pitching off sometimes chronologically, like, okay, like first this, then this, and sometimes more like, well, I think it could end with this. It's very much how one might imagine eight people sitting in a room making up a story. Right. and then. It is important, and with Justified, Graham was in there most of the time. On some shows, the showrunner is not able to be in there all the time, and so you end up, you're making up stuff, and then he'll come in for an hour and you pitch it to him, and then he'll fine-tune it. But it was very helpful in Justified that Graham was in there most of the time, so if we're going down a path he doesn't like, he can immediately say, no, I don't like that, so we can go another direction. So we don't waste 3 hours on a thing that he's going to come in and say no to in like 5 minutes. Yeah, go ahead.
So the one thing I loved about the show, and also being able to see it all at once in a binge, was Boyd's character. Boyd is such a fantastic character because, and for everyone listening, he's the bad guy for some of the seasons, but yet he's bad. Like he's not a nice guy, like no. At all. There's very few redeemable things about him. But the way Goggins plays him mm-hmm. is an absolute – like he should win an Emmy every year for that show. I mean, he was so brilliantly performed that towards the end I started seeing it as – I could start seeing it that I saw the writers were like, wait a minute. Yeah, we can't kill him off. Like they're going to get – people are going to get pissed if Boyd is gone. And I think there was a moment – I don't forgot what season it was where that kind of crossed over. Like you like – up until that point was the point of no return. Like, you know what? If we want to kill him off, we could still kill him off and we could keep moving forward. But there was a certain point where you passed, you're like, there's no way. And now he becomes almost beloved and he partners with Galen. And it's like, it was just like this one. That was the engine that ran the show for me. Just watching those two characters constantly going back and forth and the way it was just so brilliantly done. And that's very hard to pull off a character like that, like a bad guy like that with such depth and to make people feel love for him, even though they're, it's like the Hannibal Lecter thing. Like, he eats people. he eats people, and he's a cannibal. But yet, God, he's charming as hell.
Yes, and I mean, with Boyd, part of it is, a huge part of it is Walton's performance. You know, yeah. Like, he's so, like, I love him in Righteous Gemstones as Baby Billy. He's so amazing in Righteous Gemstones. If you haven't seen it, that's probably one of my favorite shows right now.
Yeah, yeah.
But Walton is so charismatic, so that helps. But also, like, very early on in season one, you have Boyd actually questioning his own motivation. You know, when he has that scene where he's like sitting there, you know, like praying because he started this cult,
right?
This, like, right? And he's like, he's like, all his guys get killed, and he's like, was I just talking to myself this whole time? And you realize, oh, he actually kind of buys his own bullshit, you know, or it's not bullshit, or he really is trying to. It's like, so it makes you realize, oh, he's not a sociopath. Right. He buys into this new thing he's into, whatever that happens to be. Right. And sometimes he knows it's partially a grift, but sometimes he really believes in what he's doing. And so because you can see that he's not trying to scam you, the audience, then you're like with him. And you also, you see him as sort of occasionally like a Robin Hood-esque character where he's standing up for the holler and he's against these other guys who are worse guys. You know, guys like Quarles or whoever, right? We had a long conversation beginning of season six about how do we end the series? You know, series, is Boyd going to die? Is Raylan going to die? Are they both going to die? Are they both going to live? Is Boyd going to be in prison? And we put all those permutations on the board and discussed them for days. And Graham had really long conversations with John Landgraf at FX about that, because he's very heavily involved in story for these shows. And I am very happy with I think we stuck the landing with how we
agreed.
Ended it.
Yeah. I agreed because he, and not going to give any spoilers out for people who haven't seen the show, but there has to be some sort of payment because he did do some bad stuff.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's interesting is in the pilot, Boyd kills that guy who's like one of his like skinhead guys who's
the
driver.
Yeah.
And he's like, and then he says to Dewey or someone, he's like, he killed him because he suspected he had betrayed him, but also he just didn't much like him. You know, and he killed a man and he was wrong about it. And he didn't really seem to feel that much remorse about it. But then as the show goes on, it's like, OK, he's the same guy. But the audience, I think even we forgot that he's the guy who just killed that dude in the car for no reason. You know, like that's who he is. And we wanted to remind the audience and ourselves who he was. And that's why in the final season, he kills Shea Whigham's character. You know, in that truck when he may not have needed to. I mean, that's a callback to that pilot moment.
Right.
And what's interesting is in talking to some fans of the show, they felt like, oh, I like how you made Boyd really bad in the end so that we might think, oh, he's going to die. And it's like that is the same as the thing he did in the pilot. We didn't make him really bad. He's doing the same kind
just
of thing.
Just reminded
right?
people.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So I don't know if we completely landed what we were trying to do because we didn't want it to feel like this cheap, now we'll make him really evil. We felt like this is totally in his character to do. He has to survive. Shea Whigham, he doesn't know this guy. It's the same thing.
No, so, and Boyd's character, I agreed with you. He was, even towards the end, he was who he was. Like he didn't change. There's just so many shades of him, and you forget that he is the guy who killed that guy for just no apparent reason. Again, I'll go back to Hannibal. It's like you forget that he ate people, and not until we start seeing him eat people do you
that's
go,
true.
Oh, because at the beginning, he's just like, oh, that's just a lovely, lovely man who happens to be behind bars, who's very eloquent. He's a little creepy, but generally we've only heard of the things he's done, but we haven't seen it. And then when you see it, you're just like, oh, he's a cannibal. What does that say about me that I like him? And then at the end of Silence of the Lambs, what happens? You're like, I hope he eats that guy.
Yes.
That's brilliant, right? That's brilliant writing, brilliant performance. And anyone listening, if you want to study a character develop, a character development through a series, Boyd is such a wonderful character to just study how you guys were able to. The nuance of Boyd's character was, again, like there's moments you're just like, God, man, I want him to die. And other moments you're like, God, I still like him. Like it was just, and again, because I binged it, I got the full.
You're like, making me want to binge it now. I'm like, man, I need to like rewatch the show.
it was a great experience being able to binge it all because you, I mean, would go 3, 4, 5 episodes a day. You know, sometimes depending on the day of the pandemic.
Right.
So we just cook through seasons, and you just really get a taste of these characters, and that's why we fell in love with them. We're like, oh God, I hope the series, the spinoff goes.
I hope so too.
Now, when you're in a writer's room, especially now, what are some mistakes you see young writers make in the room?
Oh, geez. Well, I'll say a couple of things. And one is not so much a mistake, but a thing that I think young writers should keep in mind. That, listen, when I got my first actual writing job, staff writer on season 2 of Justified, I'd been in the room, you know, many times before, subbing for the writer's assistant, just sitting in if I didn't have PA duties to do. Then I was the in-room assistant on Falling Skies. Like, I'd seen people pitch and all this stuff. And I was like, okay, I'm prepared to pitch stuff and then have it rejected. I'll be fine. But when you finally are the lowest level person and you pitch a thing and everyone's like, nah, I don't think so, and everyone just clearly hates it, it's like, oh, it makes you feel like everyone thinks I'm an idiot. I'm not going to pitch the rest of the day. I suck. And it's like you have to be – you, no matter how prepared you think you are, you're not. And you got to have that sports mentality of like a cornerback who got beat by for a touchdown. Forget it. Move on. No one's staring at you. If they are, they're a bad person. Like, no, it's like that they're moving on to the next story idea. You move on to the next story idea. I would say another thing, that a mistake that I made, and this may just be because of the way I think or whatever, I kept early on pitching things and they wouldn't land. And then 45 minutes later, someone would pitch basically the exact same thing and it would land. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? I pitched that 45 minutes ago. And what I realized is, when you're pitching a thing, people, and this may seem obvious, but it's not when you're in this room of 8 people throwing out ideas. When you say, oh, they need to find the guy in the barn, that's where the guy's hiding, you need to talk everyone through your thought process, how you got there. Because you've had this whole process, you're just blurting out, they should find him in the barn. And they're like, no, I don't think so. But then as they do that same thought process, they come to that same conclusion. So you need to talk through and say, you know, I was thinking, based on what, you know, Taylor said, since he's this kind of a guy and he did this last episode, I think he should be hiding in the barn. You got to talk people through that. And that's not an obvious thing, because you already have those thoughts. So you got to talk people through how you got there. And the other thing that I have seen, and like my brother's a TV writer also, and he's talked about having seen it. He's been on more shows than me, actually, because all these streaming shows are so short, even though he started several years later. But is people in their first job or even second job, like the low-level writers, not taking no for an answer when your boss says no, you know? And it's like, yes, if you have an idea and whoever's in charge of the room then – whether it's the number 2 or whether it's the showrunner says, I don't think so. If you are 100% certain that this is the best idea ever, maybe you say, well, can I just, maybe you say one more time, right? But you only get a couple of those. But if the boss says, no, no, we're really not going to do it, let it go. Let it go. You're not in charge. Like, I think a lot of people have this idea, and I've even heard even upper level writers say it, well, we're all going to come to something we all like. No, you're not. I don't care what anyone's saying. It is not best idea wins. It's the idea the showrunner likes wins, you know? And so you can think whatever you want. It's like, best idea wins. No, like, keep pitching the best idea that will appeal to your showrunner. You are making your boss's show, you know? You're not making what in your mind is the best version of the show. You have to figure out what is it that your boss wants out of this show.
And that's something that I think that's another thing that isn't talked a lot about in the business is the politics of the writer's room, the politics of a show, and how to maneuver through that, because that's definitely not taught at film school. and just what you just said, that little bit of knowledge that's just like, look, it's not about, like, this is not a democracy. This is not a democracy. It is a dictatorship. Yes. It is a creative dictatorship, and it is the showrunner's job to run the show. So yes. are there any little other kind of landmines that you as a writer, if you're lucky enough to get in those writer's room, or even as a PA or an assistant, to kind of avoid in the political scheme of a writer's room or of a show?
So this is a really tough one, and I don't know what the solution is, but one to have in mind is, because remember I said that the showrunner a lot of times isn't in the room, depending on the show. Right. You know, they're in the room some, but they have other things to do. They've got like 2-hour calls with an actor who has issues with a script. They have to be in post. They have to maybe be on set, etc. So oftentimes it's the number two who's in charge in the room, maybe the number three if the number two is rewriting people. And what you don't want to do is, let's say it's the number two or number three in charge in the room, and you pitch a thing or have an idea that you know the showrunner would like, but you're told no by the number two. You don't want to be the snake who's like, well, when the showrunner comes in, I'll pitch it. And that can be tough. Because you might be totally right.
Doesn't matter.
That you know the showrunner would like that. But if you are going to do that, you need to like ask the number two or number three, hey, I know you said no to this. Do you mind if I just pitch it to the boss? You know, don't just surprise him, because I know people who've done that.
And it doesn't end well.
And it's a small world out here. Word travels. You're not going to like, it's going to be tough to get another job if you're that guy. But at the same time, remember who it is who has the power to advance your career, and who it is, like we said a minute ago, whose vision it is. So again, like maybe once you get to know everybody, if it's like, man, I know the number two is not going to like this idea, but I know the showrunner is, just don't even pitch it till the showrunner is in there. Like that's a fix, you know, instead of like creating a conflict with the number two and being disrespectful to them. But also, like, sometimes you're going to get, if you're a staff writer, everyone outranks you. So sometimes you're going to get like a supervising producer or a co-EP who's going to give you certain advice, like, oh, you know what, you need to like pitch more, or you need to pitch less, or whatever. Take that with a grain of salt always, unless it's coming from the person in charge. You know, because I've known people in situations where they were given this advice by people above them, and it turned out that was not what the showrunner wanted. You know, so just like with any other business, and I think it helped me out a lot that I had been at IBM, honestly, for like 6 years. So I'd been in this corporate environment asking for feedback and saying, how did I do? You like have those conversations, you know, and I think that would be. Just being upfront and having those conversations is a huge help politically if you're not a person who's naturally politically savvy.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And now back to the show.
You know, which a lot of writers aren't necessarily. There's so many things that go into TV writing, mm-hmm. especially if you're like a producer, you know, because there's like writing, but then there's also politics. There's also management. There's so many things that go into it. And not everyone's going to be good at all those things. Right.
There's forces that you don't even see that the showrunner might be under, and the production might be under, and the stress of that. I mean, I can imagine being in the room. I mean, I worked in TV for a few minutes early in my career as a PA and worked in the office and stuff. And I would see the pressure, like, are we going to get picked up? And you could see the whole production is like, well, why even bother if we're not going to get picked up? Or that whole energy, it gets really weird. And these are things that you don't see, especially when you're young or when you're just starting out. You don't get to, you don't really understand the scope of what's going on. Like I got a great story. This PA, oh God, was so amazing. I was on a show on Fox. It was one of the first shows I was on. And the first episode finally airs. And the head office PA takes all the reviews of the show and pastes them on the wall. They were all bad reviews. So I don't even know what she was thinking. She put them all up and they were like all bad reviews. So then the showrunner shows up, reads them, has a complete meltdown. Goes into the room, breaks down. The friggin' EP has to come in, like the producer has to come in and just like try to talk him off the ledge. And like I saw, I was just first front row seat. I'm like, what are you? And like just she got her ass handed to her.
That is so weird.
It was so weird because she meant well. She meant well. She's like, oh,
it's like she didn't read them. She's just like, here's some reviews.
Here's some reviews from the LA Times and from from Variety. Let's put them all up. And everyone was like, dude, they were really bad. But that's and she meant well.
Yeah.
But obviously these are kind of these little nuances. I don't even know if she still stuck around. I don't think she stuck around very much after that. I think that might have been her last week.
Well, and as difficult as listen, when you're first starting out, you want the people above you to say, read your stuff, right?
Yeah, of course.
You know,
course.
But it's tough to know when do I ask them. And so honestly, you ask the people around you who've been doing it longer. If there's an assistant on the show, let's say you're an assistant. If there's another assistant on the show who's been doing it a few months longer than you or who knows these people, ask them for advice. Ask the lower level writers who just got staff. Be like, hey, when do you think is a good time for me to like ask them to read my stuff or make friends with all those people and let them read your stuff, you know, and because they might be a staff writer now, but they'll have a show eventually, you know, and I think that is one other thing that let me throw out there that, listen, you can absolutely succeed being a very political animal who, you know, flatters and sucks up to people. That is a legitimate strategy.
Path. It's a path,
you know,
yes.
Many people do it. It bothers me to this day when I think about even people that I think are good people that I worked around when I was an assistant or didn't matter, as they say, you know, in LA. And it's like you're having a conversation with this person in the lunchroom, let's say, you know, and then someone more important comes in. It is a Hollywood thing. I'm sure you've experienced it. All of a sudden, the conversation with you ends. You do not exist anymore. And now it's time to talk to this EP who walked in. It is as if that conversation never happened. And that happened to me numerous times. And oh, yeah. At first I was super offended. And then I was like, I guess this is just how things work. But you know what I remember? I remember the people who never did that. I remember the people who were like, okay, I know I'm talking to this PA who doesn't matter, but I'm going to finish that conversation before I'm not going to act as if royalty has walked in, you know,
and that's not to say
you don't show respect to people who've earned it. I'm just saying I would love to see a culture change where people just treat everyone like people. And I know that might be asking too much of Hollywood, but I'll throw it out there.
It might be a little much. I don't think that's going to happen right now. But it is getting better. It is definitely getting better than where it was, without question. But that's the thing in LA, you know. And by the way, I moved the exact same year you moved. I was three months.
Oh, that's funny.
It was 3 months prior to the collapse, the financial crisis. Okay. So, and I was lucky that I was able to skate right through all of that. Thank God. But I moved literally just a few months before the
we were probably at the same coffee shops occasionally.
Probably.
I was at a lot of coffee shops.
What part of town did you move into?
We were at Park La Brea at first. I would go to Insomnia Cafe on Beverly. I would go to a lot of the normal spots, Literati and Santa Monica, all those places.
I was over in Burbank. So I was down the street from Warner's and Disney and Universal and stuff. So I was every Starbucks, every Coffee Bean. That was the one thing. I don't know if you got the same experience. The second I kept going to all these coffee shops and all I would see is laptops with Final Draft. Everywhere.
That is LA for you. And honestly, it depends on the day whether I like it or hate it.
Right. It was just such a culture shock from coming from the East Coast when I moved. Now, you also worked on SWAT, which is completely very, very different than Justified because this is a procedural. Now, yeah. I wanted to find out from you when you when I watch procedurals and I've watched a lot. Like I was a big fan of Bones and I would watch and that was another one we binged during the thing. So I saw 13 seasons.
That's a lot of binging.
It was a lot about Bones now.
Bones in general.
I know way more than I should about Bones. But that was like you know that was a good 3 months of just like what are we watching tonight? Bones it is. But I always liked watching procedurals because there is an overarching arc of the characters. There's an overarching arc of the plot of the show of the season, but they keep sticking in weekly. You know the weekly
yeah.
murder, the weekly
yeah.
this
the case of the week,
how,
yeah
the case
yeah.
of the week. So how do you balance that in the writer's room?
Yeah, so like with procedurals, like before I had worked on one. I definitely there was a little bit of an elitist vibe among those people like myself who were working on prestige cable of procedurals.
Right.
But then once I worked on one, I was like, oh my God, this is so difficult. It is a whole other skill. It's not right. like before I was working on one, I was like, oh, case of the week, sure. How easy is that? You don't have to balance all this stuff. No, it is so difficult to keep getting those fun character beats in there because people aren't watching it just for the mystery. It's not like they want robots solving the mystery. They want these fun characters that they care about, you know, solving the mystery and for it to have ramifications on who the character is. And fitting that in along with an entire plot in the 42 minutes or whatever we have, because you still have to have that beginning, middle, and end of a mystery of a case of the week. You got to have a client. You got the person that we're saving or like we're solving their mystery or whatever. And so that's a guest character who has to have an arc. And you've got to have like little B stories, relationship stories. And as you said, you've got to serve like maybe one or two beats of the overarching season long arc for Hondo in the case of SWAT. And I would just say it's a huge challenge. It took me like half the first season of SWAT to really get a grip on it. Like, fortunately, there were a lot of people on that show who understood procedurals and could help me through that. But a big part of it that was helpful for me is the way that Sean Ryan breaks TV, which is that he does not break sequentially. Like when you're putting up the teaser, act one, act two, whatever, he doesn't do that first. The first thing we do is figure out, okay, what's the A story? What's the mystery of this episode? And we just break that in a single line. Forget acts. It's like, what are the every single scene of the A story? Now, what's the B story? What's the relationship story? Or who's our character who's learning something this episode? Like, Luca is learning that do we want to do a story where Luca learns that he actually doesn't want to be in a leadership position, you know, that it's just pride that makes him want to do that. He really is happy being like the wingman, right? Then, okay, we're going to break that story out separately on the board. You know, it's like separately of everything, no acts or anything. Here are the scenes of that. And then is there a C story that's the overall Hondo arc? Like, okay, Hondo has taken on his friend's son as Daryl. He's taking care of him while his friend is in prison. So we want like a couple beats of that. How are we moving along the story? And we write those out. And that is a huge help because there's so many things going on in a procedural that if you break it sequentially, you really lose track of like, okay, well, what storyline are we in? And it's so helpful to me to break them separately. So like if I were doing a procedural pilot now, that's how I would break it, is do the storyline separately, then weave them together. And what you often find is, oh, this B story beat for Luca where he's learning about leadership that can combine with this A story mystery beat. He can learn this thing about leadership as part of this mystery beat, right? And if you watch The Shield, which isn't technically procedural, but it always has some case of the week, whether it's Dutch and Claudette might have a case, or or Danny and I can't remember the cop she's partnered with have a case. There's always some storyline that ends. You can see the way, or I can, having worked for Sean, you can see how Sean breaks things in that show, because you see the B story and C story and A story aligning, and you can imagine in your head how he broke them separately, and then they combined.
No, no, like as you're explaining all this, I just my head hurts. It's just so many.
So I didn't make it easier by explaining.
No, it's because it was wonderful, but like just thinking about it, you're absolutely like you walk it like if it was me walking into a writer's room like, oh, it's procedural. It's procedural. One a week, it's done. We do a couple things. But then you start thinking about all the characters have to have their own arcs. They have to have their own beats inside of each one. And then you've got to work in a beat for the main character and then how those represent. Like there's so many characters, so many story beats, and then throw in the murder of the week or case of the week.
Right, right.
And then interact those with the beats that you need to hit for everybody and for the season. Like my head wants to explode. Like it's insane. It's like that seems so much more difficult than Justified, where it is not a procedural, which is like a story arc through the whole thing.
Right, and obviously, like we, especially season one, it played out more like a procedural early on season one.
Right,
and in Justified, the first half of every season and maybe beyond would always have like some close-ended story. But the close-ended story took up, like in SWAT, that close-ended story is 60 to 75% of the episode. In Justified, it was more like 25 to 50% of the episode, right? But that was part of how Graham wanted to break it. And I think it was – I love that because it's very important to me in a TV show that each episode has its own has its own thing. It has a character to it. Like what I would always say in Justified is, okay – this is the one where blank. Is this the you want when people are talking about the show, what are they going to say this one's about? You know, like there are some shows like Damages is one of the most one most famously where it's just a serial. It's just 20 episodes or 13 episodes that they're just like cutting the story at certain spots, you know. But to me, and I think honestly, that's one of the things that I think people love about Succession is so many prestige shows are so serialized where it's like you can't even remember what episode things happened, even if you like it. In Succession, it's like, oh no, this is the one at the retreat. This is the one.
Right.
This is the one at this. Like, because I mean, they're shooting at all different locations. Like each episode has its own character, and I you know, like it has. It's like, oh, that's the one where blank. That's the one where blank. I think that's very important and a thing that's in streaming can get lost. You know, I mean, one of the reasons people love Squid Game. This is the one with this game. This is the one with this game. Right.
Well, I mean, first of all, Succession's on the list. Haven't seen it yet, so I'm now going to binge it. Now it is on the literally on the, that and
it's
Ted Lasso.
It's super bingeable. It's super bingeable.
And Ted Lasso is
because I'm catching up. Also, I started it really late. I'm in the middle of season two, so that's why it's on the mind because I'm binging that right now.
Right. Yeah. Because I was like, oh, I keep hearing about it, and then I was in Austin at the Austin Film Festival, and then friends, I'm like, have you not seen Succession? What's wrong with you? Like, I'm like, okay. Obviously, have you not seen Ted Lasso? I'm like, no, I've never seen Ted Lasso. I'm like, okay, you gotta watch Ted Lasso. I'm like, all right, we'll go through that. it's really interesting the whole process and how we do. Oh, like in Squid Games, by the way, Squid Games. Let's talk about Squid Games for a second. What was it in your opinion, being a professional television writer, that caught our attention with Squid Games? Because I watched the whole thing, obviously. And I like after the first episode took me a minute. And then at the end of the episode, you're like, oh, okay. And then you're in. They hook you with that first episode. And then it was just like me and my wife are just sitting there looking like, this is a well-written show. I mean, I thought it was a well-written show. And the way they keep the characters going. And even though the acting, in my opinion, was a little bit over the top sometimes and things like that. But emotionally, they got me. What was it about? I'm assuming you saw Squid Games.
Yeah, I think isn't it like an 8 episode or 9 episode? I think that I'm on episode 5 or 6. I haven't finished it because that's one that I haven't been binging partially. And this is because so often when I'm watching TV, I'm eating. And so if there's something with subtitles, then I keep missing stuff.
Right,
so I have to watch Squid Game last in the evening when I'm done with my snacking. So sometimes I don't make it to it. But no, I don't know. I mean, I think I, along with every executive in Hollywood is trying to figure out, what do people love about Squid Game? I mean, it might honestly be as simple as it's a really like wild premise that then when you tell people about, it's going to spread like wildfire.
It's definitely high concept.
Like,
yeah,
there's this show where blank, right? Yes, it's high concept.
Super high concept.
It has very interesting visuals. And like I spent like that first episode, like the first game, the red light, green light.
Oh.
And like, though, like that's not something, those visuals, the way that setup is not something we see that much in American TV. You know, I don't know how normal it is in Korean TV. And so it's like, oh, I haven't seen anything like this, but I get it. It's not confusing because so much. I feel like streaming's doing a better job of not being confusing. But for a while there, I felt like every prestige show, I would be like halfway through the pilot and have no idea who's the main character. What do they want? There's lots of people looking at each other and like
they're angry.
Shot of the ocean. I don't know what's going on, right? But it's very clear what's going on, and it's very clear why people are doing things. You know, like some people would even argue it's like simplistic, but you get it. You get it. You care about these people because they have understandable issues, whether they caused it for themselves or not. And, you know, what's that huge? You want to see what happens next. You want to see what the next game is. You know, even though it's not a procedural, it has an engine. You want to see what that next game is.
Right. And now the showrunner's like, oh, we're doing season two now. And it's like, and now you want, and I won't ruin the show for you, but now you're like, okay, I want to go back to this world, as violent and insane as it is.
Sure. Yeah.
And it says something about us to want to watch things like that. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions, ask all my guests. What advice would you give a screenwriter wanting to break into the business today?
So I'll say that on the feature side, I'll give the advice that my friend Dan Kunkka always gives, and he sells a lot of scripts, is write your spec. Like like every year there's an army of people saying, the spec script market's over, only this many scripts sold. And every year, hundreds, if not more, of scripts still sell, plenty of them from people who haven't sold them before. So like write that script. Yes, you can get caught up in, oh, well, I won this contest with this feature script. Now I'm getting offers to go pitch on stuff. Yeah, sure. Go pitch, write your next spec, right? A really good spec still can find a buyer. And when you write a thing, you can sell it 5 years from now. If you pitch something based on someone else's IP, that was 2 months wasted if it doesn't sell. Not saying don't do it. I'm saying a script you write lasts forever. Mm-hmm. And on the TV side also, I would say keep writing new things. I know a lot of people trying to break in who are like, hey, will you read my stuff? And it's like, okay, what do you have? Well, I have this one script I've been rewriting for 5 years. And that's easy to happen. Like, mm-hmm. You keep rewriting the same thing. No, cut it off, write a new thing. You can go back and revisit it later. You can rewrite it for 5 years in the background. Write a new thing because you're going to get better every time you write a thing. Then write another thing. Then write another thing. And if you don't have a workshop group, find one. Maybe the first group you try to create or join doesn't work out. You don't like the people in it. Find a group of people who you trust to give you notes and for you to give them notes, because number one, you learn things when you're giving other people notes. Number two, you're going to make contacts with people who are trying to do the same thing you're doing. And number three, you can learn a lot about how to take notes, which is a huge part of this job if you get to do it. That is, a lot of this job is being able to take notes. And your stuff will get better through the workshop group. I was in a workshop group in grad school, which helped me out. I'm still in two workshop groups with other writers who we've kind of come up together. One of which when we started the group, we were all assistants, and now we're all on shows, you know?
Nice.
And so we all like came up together. So I think that's a huge thing. And don't be shy about telling people what it is you want to do, because you never know like who can help you out. Don't be precious about it. Like, it's just a hobby, you know, or not telling anyone what you want to do, especially if you've moved to LA and you're having contact with people in the industry. I don't care what they do.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Let them know. Yeah, I'm doing this right now. But yeah, I want to be, you know, a TV writer, and I'm working on this kind of a spec right now, or whatever. Let people know what it is you want to do. So those are the pieces of advice I'd give.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Wow.
These are my Oprah questions.
Man, I would say in life, and this is something some people just don't have an issue with. Like if you're someone who like was in improv or did drama or was a great salesman, you don't have to learn this lesson. You already know it. But just like not being – don't – be a rock star about things. And this is – I'm stealing this from another person. And what I mean by that is if you're who's a rock star now? Like, if you're who's the guy who did that? If you're The Weeknd, The Weeknd, sure. And you're like talking to some people, and you like tell a joke and no one laughs at it, you don't care because you're The Weeknd. You know, like if you like make a mistake and call someone by the wrong name, you don't beat yourself up about it all day because you're The Weeknd. Who cares? And if you're and you're not afraid to go talk to a stranger, you're not afraid to you know, be honest about what you think about something or be upfront because you're The Weeknd, you know, act like you're The Weeknd, you know, it's like because you're the only one who's sitting around beating yourself up about that thing you said earlier. And it's like, oh, I won't talk in, you know, I just won't talk to groups of people anymore. I had to learn that networking is not a dirty word. Mm-mm. You know, because right. It's like, no, you're just networking is meeting and talking to people about something you both enjoy and love. You know, it, like, don't be afraid to like break into that group of people if you're at Austin Film Festival or whatever. Like, what is the worst that can happen? You know,
it's not gonna, it's not the Squid Games. It's not the Squid Games.
Yes, that's right. That is a thing that I still have to remind myself of. Like, all your regrets are going to be when you were too shy. Mm-hmm. And didn't speak up. So be The Weeknd.
And all, just be The Weeknd. It's just the best advice you can give. Just be The Weeknd. And three television pilots that every writer should read.
Oh, wow. Pilots that people should read, not watch. Well, I mean, Breaking Bad. Yeah. Probably everyone's already read that. I'm trying to do it where they're not all from the same era, but I think Mad Men is one because that's an example of what did Matt Weiner wrote that like a decade before they ended up making it, something like that. I know he made some changes, but I'd say Mad Men is one. That's also one of my favorite shows. What's another good one? You know what? Read the Justified pilot. That is that's a really good pilot that from my understanding, Graham got very few notes on. So what you're reading is almost, I mean, it's never your first draft, but as close to like a first draft of a pilot, you know, like I think he got one big note and then he added a scene at the end. But apart from that, it's and apart from talking about reshoots, famously, Walton Goggins' character died when they shot that pilot. In the pilot, Boyd died. He tested so well. This is a one time when testing actually worked out. It tested so well, they did a reshoot where they're carrying him out in a stretcher and he's alive. And where would the show be if Boyd had not lived?
Wow. So, I didn't so, know. That's
people,
awesome.
People talk crap about testing, and it is annoying, like, but it worked out for Justified. But yeah, read the Justified pilot too.
VJ, man, it has been a pleasure talking to you, brother. It really has. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience and continued success, sir, in the business. I appreciate you, man.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Alex.
I want to thank VJ so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, VJ. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/152. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.